Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. It's good to be here.
And we're really pleased to have a guest with us this week. That's Chris Goswami. How are you, Chris?
I'm great, and it's great to be here, Tim. Thanks.
For those who haven't come across you and your writing on the internet on many topics in the past, do you want kind of briefly explaining who you are and what you do and what leads you to our door today?
Yeah, sure. So I've worked in the tech industry for over 30 years, software development, telecommunications companies, Silicon Valley companies, and just kind of retired from that job earlier last year. In parallel, I'm a Baptist minister at a local church here in Cheshire. And then the third thing I do is I do write on my website, which is called 7minutes.net, the number 7minutes.net, on matters of that I come across that cross life and faith, and in particular technology and faith, as that is my background.
Well, we're really pleased to have you on the show, in particular because we're tackling a quite complicated topic today, which is cryptocurrency, something that I think is almost daily in the news, and yet something a lot of Christians, I think, are probably still struggling to wrap their heads around. Before we go any further, we want to state very upfront that this episode and the next week's episode, we're going to be carrying on talking to Chris. We're going to talk a lot about cryptocurrency, about finance, about investment. None of this counts as investment advice. None of the three of us are trained financial advisors, and so please do not use anything we say to do or not do anything. If you're wondering about what to do with your own money, please go and speak to a properly financially regulated and trained professional. This is just three kind of lay Christians interested in tech trying to bat around some of these important ideas. I guess the first thing before we kind of dig into the meat of this is to try and explain for those who are really baffled what exactly a cryptocurrency is. Chris, do you want to have a stab at that, and we'll see where we get to?
Yeah, and it's not an easy concept to get your head around. And some of the coins that are called cryptocurrency aren't currencies, but some of them are. So let's step back, and if you cast your mind back to 2008. And the year that institutions that couldn't fail suddenly failed, and institutions that couldn't possibly go bankrupt went bankrupt, and they were the banks. They failed not just in the UK, but around the world, and we now call that the financial crash of 2008. Now, in the aftermath of that 2008 crash, a lot of things changed. Some regulation around banks changed, but a group of people or persons, we can come back to who that is, came up with a vision. They produced a white paper for a new vision for a new currency called Bitcoin. And they proposed that this new currency shouldn't depend on banks that can fail disastrously. In fact, it shouldn't depend on banks at all. It'd be a new form of tender, independent of any of the then financial organizations. So that was the vision. But the question then is, what exactly is Bitcoin, and where does it come from? So I'm going to use a comparison here of digging for gold, which I think is something that if we haven't done, I haven't done it, but we all understand that. So if you think about it, mining for gold, if you want to look for gold, you can go out legally, you can buy a spade, go up to Scotland where there are traces of gold and start digging. And if you're really lucky, you might find gold. We call it mining. Obviously, on a more industrial scale, most of the time, that's how gold is mined. Well, bitcoins also are mined. They are mined, but not by digging holes in the ground. They are mined by computers solving puzzles. So the people who set up Bitcoin devised this complex puzzle algorithm to which even they don't know the solutions, but there are a number of solutions. And now what we find is there are thousands of computers around the world which trying to find solutions to this Bitcoin problem. Every time they find a solution, everybody else in the Bitcoin network, in the Bitcoin chain, agrees that the person who found the solution, the next solution, owns a Bitcoin. So if you find a solution, Tim or John, you own a Bitcoin, and we all agree that you own a Bitcoin. So that's one similarity to gold. Another similarity to gold is that if you think about it, gold doesn't actually have any value intrinsically in itself. It's just a metal. It's shiny and it's yellow and we like the look of it. It has value because around the world we've all agreed that gold, an ounce of gold, is worth so much in dollars or pounds. So similarly, enough people have agreed around the world that when you find a solution to this puzzle and you get a Bitcoin, that has a certain value. So then it becomes usable as a currency for which you can use to buy and sell on the internet. Now, the kind of third bit of this, if you like, and then I'll stop, is the whole network of computers around the world that are searching for Bitcoins, and there are thousands of them. They monitor every transaction, every Bitcoin transaction that occurs on the internet. So let's say I bought a pair of trainers on Amazon, and you can indirectly use Bitcoin on Amazon. Let's say I bought a pair of trainers. All the thousands of computers around the world that are managing Bitcoin agree that Chris Goswami now owns one less Bitcoin. Let's say it's an expensive pair of trainers. One less Bitcoin, and Amazon has one more Bitcoin. And we call that network of computers that monitor and manage Bitcoin transactions around the world the blockchain. It's a technical term, but that it just means this online ledger. So that's the idea. It's you know, you could then ask the question, well, can I use my computer, or can you use your computer to mine Bitcoin? And the answer is yes, you can download free software to mine Bitcoin. But realistically, you need a warehouse full of computers to realistically have a chance to solving this puzzle, in much the same way that you could buy a spade and go off, you know, down the road and say, I'm going to dig for gold. You can definitely do that and you might find some, but you probably won't. You need industrial equipment and intelligence. So that's I hope that helps just set the playing field there.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thanks so much, Chris. I guess what is interesting and what is new, I mean, we've had digital money, as it were, you know, traditional currencies, pounds and dollars, have, you know, people are very familiar that you can buy and sell and send money over the internet. And in fact, the vast majority of transactions in old currencies now happen that way. You know, cash is a vanishingly small proportion of that. So I guess what we need to be clear is that what differentiates Bitcoin as a digital currency is not that it's all on the internet and doesn't actually have any physical form, but that it's not, there's no central bank underpinning it. You know, so the key thing for the dollar is that there's the US Federal Reserve, which holds stores of gold and other things in its vaults and regulates and manages the flow of the currency. And a key thing that Satoshi Nakamoto, the person or persons who invented Bitcoin, wanted to avoid was that there should be no one single central bank that could control this currency. It's often called decentralized finance, or DeFi, because it's kind of belongs to everyone. And that's the key critical, I guess, breakthrough of the blockchain, is that it allows kind of, you can trust that Amazon does have one more Bitcoin and Chris has one less, because the blockchain is a public ledger, but it is irreversible. Once a transaction's been added to the blockchain, it can never be taken away and can't be tampered with.
So you've absolutely hit a key point there, which is that when we do normal transactions, either in real life or on the internet, as you pointed out, Tim, financial institutions are involved. So I might use my Visa card or MasterCard or American Express. They're involved. Then it gets settled by a bank, HSBC or Barclays. They're involved at that point. And as you pointed out, a key difference here is there are no financial institutions involved. It's kind of crowdsourced, if you like many things on the internet, that we just agree. So the three of us just agree between us, as we could, that Chris now owns one less Bitcoin and somebody else owns one more Bitcoin. But there's no bank, there's no credit card company, there's nothing like that. Correct.
And so, thanks very much, Chris, because it's a very helpful overview. I think another fascinating aspect of all this is that, therefore, effectively, it seems there's no regulation. You know, so if I'm trying to open an account in a bank these days, it's like getting into Fort Knox, isn't it? They want to know absolutely everything about you. They need your passport. They need your, you know, your proof of identity. There's clearly a whole lot of security measures looking out for money laundering and money coming from dodgy sources and all the rest. But the whole point about Bitcoin and these other cryptocurrencies is that they appear to be completely unregulated at present, and nobody really knows. It's crowdfunding, it's crowdsourced, and so they've got this very dodgy reputation, haven't they? So, for instance, I understand that a lot of the ransomware that's going around, where some big company gets trapped by software, and they're asked to pay a ransom in Bitcoin in order to release their, you know, so the criminals are using Bitcoin, presumably as a way of evading regulation. So how does that work? If it's an open ledger, how can a criminal be using it?
Well, let's talk about, let's address that in a couple of steps. First of all, is it a good thing or a bad thing to remove banks and traditional financial institutions from the system? So yes and no. Removing banks from the system achieves the vision that Satoshi Nakamoto, the person or persons who invented this, had, which is to reduce the dependence on institutions that can fail and that also cost money. So every time the bank manages a transaction for you or for me, somebody has to get paid, an office has to get heated, etc., etc. That costs money, it takes time. On the other hand, as you've kind of intimated, banks have a pretty clear idea of who's spending money, and they have a reputation of blocking financial activity, which appears illegitimate. So I think, you know, we would all say that your banks are not perfect, but at this point they are well regulated. But I think this idea that it's a source of criminal activity. So the online ledger, this network of users of Bitcoin, is actually very hard to hack, first of all. In fact, it's almost impossible to hack. If you want to hack the system, the Bitcoin system, you have to attack thousands, possibly millions of computers worldwide simultaneously. That makes it very secure and very traceable, that we know, we can trace when a Bitcoin transaction happens, and we can trace when it gets converted into actual currency. Now, in terms of criminal activity, that is an accusation that's come up against Bitcoin a number of times. A number of things that you could say about that is, you know, actually, is that any different, really? So if you think about cash, for example, you know, there are institutions, big and small. So there's a fast food place in my town that only takes cash. Why is that? I don't know. It might be legitimate, or there may be a tax incentive for them, an illegal tax incentive. And so there is actually a lot of unethical trading going on anyway. Now, there's very little actual hard evidence that more unethical activity is happening with crypto than with other forms of payment.
So just again to clarify, from my own understanding, when a criminal is using Bitcoin, everybody would know, like, the IP address of the computer or whatever, but they wouldn't necessarily know precisely who was operating it. Or is it possible to, you know, to use software techniques to hide your identity?
Yes, you can use software techniques to hide your identity. It's difficult, but you can do that. But there have been some high-profile prosecutions of criminals who have tried to use Bitcoin to mask their activity. You know, you could look those up. And again, I would say, there's not much evidence that there's proportionally more illegal activity with Bitcoin than other forms of payment. It's new, and that is a problem for people, that we don't understand it. That can lead us into places where we do end up losing money.
Listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
The kind of the thing that triggered us deciding to tackle this as a topic on Matters of Life and Death really was what's being called crypto winter. So that's this kind of probably about nine, maybe even a year, where the value of Bitcoin, most prominently, but a whole host, if not all, cryptocurrencies has been plummeting after a kind of peak during the kind of earlier years of the COVID era, and with it, lots of kind of high profile crypto institutions, most recently FTX, which is a kind of exchange where you could buy and sell different cryptocurrencies and convert them from different into traditional currencies, completely fell apart, and its kind of leadership has now been arrested and charged with various kind of fraudulent activity, and several others. Do you think, well, I guess one, what is going on here? Why is the kind of sector taking a battering at the moment? And two, this is kind of creating a lot of nervousness or anxiety among people who might have invested in or kind of considering that. Is that good anxiety, or should we say actually this kind of, let's take a step back and calm down, it's not the end of crypto as we know it?
I think the first thing I'd say, Tim, is that if we'd done this interview, let's say this time last year, I think the tone of the conversation would have been different, because all cryptocurrencies were on the rise, they were soaring, and maybe we would more have been saying, hey, you know, this seems really good, how good can it get? But in fact, you're right. In the last 6 months, certainly in the last year, most cryptocurrencies, possibly all of them, have plummeted, even crashed in value. In fact, it's estimated that something like $2 trillion has vanished from cryptocurrencies since November 2021. Again, you know, let's compare this to like things that are to like. Let's compare like to like, okay? And I want to use the example of internet technology and internet businesses. If you think back, and I think all of us are old enough to remember the internet being quite new in the early 90s, there was a period of growth, and then there was a period of hypergrowth, of inflated growth, of hype. And around 2001, we had what we call the dot-com bubble, where actually hundreds of companies that were overvalued, overinflated in value, either went bust or lost share value. So the company that I worked for, which was a company called Open Wave Systems, Silicon Valley-based company, in 2001, its share value was, or before the crash, was something like $400. I don't remember immediately what it went down to, but just a couple of years later, the share value was less than a dollar, right? Wow. So hundreds of times. Yeah, that's when I got them. my share options came at a dollar each. So that's great. But
Back to the drawing board.
Yeah, but here's the thing. And some people became very rich and some people lost lots of money. Yeah. There were stories in Silicon Valley of gorgeous ladies going out with very geeky software engineers, marrying them.
So that wasn't you, Chris, rich. Then, was
that
it?
That wasn't me, actually. Oh, no, I wish it was. No. Marrying them and divorcing them and taking half their money. So it was an absolute inflation and then a plummeting. And that kind of bandwagon, that isn't that unusual with disruptive technologies on the internet. It's not that unusual. You know, so another example. I used to work on a school governor's board with some other chaps. And I remember one of the guys coming in one day. He worked for AstraZeneca, very creditable, well-known pharmaceutical company. And we had a chat. He says, "Oh, it's terrible! It's terrible! The share price of AstraZeneca has crashed. It's crashed." And I said, "What? You mean what? It's gone down what 10% or something?" He said, "Yeah, 10%, almost 10%." And I said, "My company does that every week." It's up 10, it's up 12, it's down 9. That is internet technology. It's just where most of us are not in that area. And even in crypto, there have been other crashes, not as big as this one, but other crashes due to over-speculation. But the cycle repeats. And some would say, we on this podcast are not offering investment advice, but some people would say that this is the right time to invest. And I think it's interesting that like Bitcoin has halved in value from something like $36,000 per Bitcoin to 15 or 16 now. But it's still there at a quite high value. There are still millions of people using it. And it's a resistant network. It's still continuing. It still has millions of followers. And I think it comes down to what we're used to and what we're not used to.
But speculation, of course, has been around for centuries, hasn't it? I mean, I'm remembering about the Dutch tulip boom, wasn't there? I mean, so this idea of massive speculative gambles, really, followed by disastrous crashes and people losing all their money and so on, it's not new, but it does seem... there's something about the whole internet fintech world, isn't there, which encourages... it's so easy to click. You know, online gambling, isn't it? And I just remember the stocks and shares, the... what was that video company where a whole bunch of day traders...
GameStop, yeah.
That's right.
Pumped up the
they
stock.
They pumped it up, made a massive profit, so then it went...
Then it crashed.
Crashed. Yeah. So, in a sense, I mean, at that end of the market, it's very much like a casino, isn't it? It's a form of gambling.
Well, I think there certainly are some people who view it as gambling, and it can be gambling. And I think, you know, on the next edition of this podcast, we're going to talk about ethical arguments from the Bible, and you know, you could, there is this thing, this FOMO, fear of missing out, as well. However, I guess what I'd say about that is, you know, some people say it's like, isn't it a Ponzi scheme, where it's just you're just actually waiting for the value of this thing to rise and pulling in more people to invest in it, so that the bitcoins that you've got will go up in value, okay? But that actually isn't that different to investing in many other assets or commodities. You know, if you invest in gold, you're just sitting there with an ounce of gold, or, you know, ownership of an ounce of gold, waiting for the price to go up. So if you're, and you know, if people are doing this as part of a portfolio, or they're doing it because they are happy with the ethics, and we'll come to the ethics soon, and it's part of their investment portfolio, then I think I would not agree. It's like gambling. It's only as like gambling as investing in many other commodities or even some companies, you know.
Isn't the difference between traditional investment, that, and again, not an investment advice, not a financially trained person, but if you invest in, you know, even some of those dot-com companies that were absurdly overvalued, and there was a necessary, though painful, correction. They did provide services, you know. Pets.com is a classic example. Like, it did actually sell pet food. It probably wasn't worth what people thought it was, but it sold a service that had value. And similarly, if you invest, if you're buying and selling oil or some other commodity, oil is not a mythical substance. It exists, and you can take a barrel of oil, you could just hold on to it and wait for the price to go up and sell it, but you could also use it to power your car or to you know, run a generator. And I guess the argument often goes that, unlike this, cryptocurrencies are completely intangible, and they have no functional utility except to fluctuate in value, and so you hope to buy low and sell high, particularly because they're so volatile, they struggle to actually act as a currency. Because imagine the pound in your pocket was worth one day, you know, it was worth 72 cents, let's say, in the US currency, and the next day it was worth 70,000 cents, and then the next day it was down to 70 cents again. You can't actually use that as a unit of exchange because it's far too volatile. Traditional currencies, they change in value, but by fractions of a percent. So realistically, the argument goes, I'd love to hear your response to this, cryptocurrencies are actually just speculative investments, but unlike traditional investments, it's thin air, and so it is purely kind of tulip mania, but you can't even, at least you could plant a tulip bulb in the ground and have a beautiful flower.
So I think this is a strong argument against cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, but it's not as one-sided as you've just said. So it is true, I think I would agree, that if you invest in stocks and shares or as part of a balanced pension portfolio, as I have, and perhaps I'm sure you have as well, and so my pension portfolio is in what's called ESG funds, environmental and socially well-governed funds. And so, you know, I do that because my investments, hopefully, are used to provide jobs, you know, for companies to grow, to provide education, provide work. And I'm investing in that. And I think that is a strong argument. However, Proponents of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies would say, well, it's not as intangible as you suggest. If you invest in Bitcoin now, the network is so big, you are investing in a network and you are investing in technology, which we'll come to later, this blockchain thing, which is used in other industries and to support other industries. You're investing in actually in a world of in a new industry, in an upcoming industry. And it is true, actually, that you know, your big City of London financial organizations, they are now employing bright young people who to pursue solutions based on cryptocurrencies. Wall Street, City of London, they are employing people now to pursue solutions based on cryptocurrencies. So not to the same degree, but it's not true that it's you're just investing in something waiting for it to go up.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Can I just raise another sort of ethical issue, which is about the amount of energy that is used to generate these, you know, to perform these mathematical puzzles? As you say, there are thousands, if not millions, of computers as we speak, whirring away, chewing up energy, doing nothing more useful than trying to solve a mathematical puzzle. And apparently, you know, the people, these so-called Bitcoin miners who are most successful have warehouses full of these things. And people have calculated, haven't they, the amount of energy that's being consumed, the amount of carbon dioxide that's being created, and it's equivalent to a sort of small to medium-sized country, apparently. So isn't that a major problem for the use of this kind of technology?
Yeah, and I think, again, I would largely agree, but again, it's not nearly as one-sided as that. But for example, when we were just chatting before we started recording, I was just mentioning there's a guy in my town. It's a very small town I live in, only 12,000 people. He's a couple of streets away. And this fellow has in his basement 168 computers. And those 168 computers are doing nothing except mine Bitcoin. And he hasn't turned his heating on for 2 years. And he's even offered his immediate neighbour spare heat. And the immediate neighbour is the plumber, I don't think he went for it. But so this is an argument, and particularly in the current climate, pun intended, you know, is this completely irresponsible? And arguments against Bitcoin would say it's irresponsible, that not only is it a zero-sum game, where you're just investing in something intangible and waiting for it to go up or down, it's actually a negative sum game, because there are negative externalities. You are damaging the world. Okay. Now let me just give the opposite arguments to that, because there are opposite arguments. First of all, it isn't just solving mathematical puzzles. There are people now whose jobs in financial institutions depend on cryptocurrencies and bitcoins. It is an upcoming industry, number one. Number two, you have to compare it to traditional finance and banking. So, for example, if you walk through the City of London, you know, there are offices and they're all lit, and there are computers and there are computer servers that are using electricity. There are cooling systems to cool them down. So there is also energy being spent on traditional finances as well. The last thing I'd say, again, to somewhat mitigate this argument against Bitcoin, is that I believe that Bitcoin now uses worldwide, something like two-thirds renewable energy. Okay, so two-thirds of its energy is renewable sources. You could still argue, well, that energy could be used to provide jobs, etc. But two-thirds of it is green energy, and that's happened because most of the mining operation that used to be in China, and it was using dirty energy, coal-fired energy. Most Bitcoin mining is now done outside of China.
Very interesting. I suppose it really depends on, I guess, your kind of optimism for the future of the sector. As you say, if you see Bitcoin as a, you know, it's barely 15 years old, it's a kind of nascent technological breakthrough that we're still figuring out. Every Bitcoin transacted, every Bitcoin mined could be seen as an investment in a future kind of financial model, which could revolutionize the next century. And the counter argument, I suppose, is that this is ultimately a large and more technology complex version of something like, you know, Tulip Mania, where for years people became convinced that, you know, tulips held huge value and there were crazy auctions and prices, and then overnight the delusion broke and it crashed, and suddenly we realized that these are just flower bulbs and they're worth a few pence at most. Do you worry about the future of the sector? Do you think that the crypto winter might not just be part of an up and down, but might actually be the kind of beginning of a complete the bubble bursting?
I suppose you know, my perspective coming from the tech industry, you know, I don't know. I do believe that Bitcoin is here to stay. I believe the technologies that underpin Bitcoin are very much here to stay. And actually there are also, which we haven't talked about yet, but there are some fairly strong ethical arguments in favour of crypto and Bitcoin as well. So I think that would be my view.
Before we get back to today's show, I want to introduce you to Christopher Gasson, who has a new book about finding God in atheist books. Christopher, what inspired you to write The Devil's Gospels?
I was running a teenage discussion group at Oxford's University Church when I decided that the best way to help them build their faith upon a rock was to tackle atheism head on. Each month we explored a different atheist book. I found two things. First, these writers like Dawkins and Nietzsche aren't really a threat to God. They're mainly angry about how the church has interpreted Jesus' teaching, and I think we can learn from that. Second, I found that the grown-ups in the church also really wanted better answers to atheist challenges.
So do you think we can become better Christians by reading atheist books?
That's the paradox, but I think it's very much in line with what the university church is all about. Oxford University was founded on the principle that everything that we can learn about the world will deepen our understanding of God. That's as true today as it was 900 years ago, and it applies as much to science as it does to the humanities, and indeed atheism.
So Christopher, where can we find the book?
The Devil's Gospels is available on Amazon and in all good bookshops. Otherwise, head to thedevilsgospels.com where you can find more details.
Thank you, Christopher. And now back to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Are there kind of good arguments in favour of using Bitcoin, of promoting and expanding its kind of the kind of sector? What are the ethical arguments that might lead us to say, actually, this is a good thing and we need to get involved?
Yeah, no, thanks, Tim. So, you know, one argument we covered last time was, you know, this is an industry, and if you invest in Bitcoin, to some extent, arguably, you are investing in an industry that is up and coming. But there are two other big ethical arguments, I think, which I'd like to cover off briefly, about empowering young people and empowering people in developing countries. So what do I mean by that? Well, proponents of Bitcoin would say this is about empowering young people who basically have been left behind, that economies are biased against the young people, particularly Gen Z people. And in fact, you find most people who argue against Bitcoin tend to be kind of baby boomers or people above 40.
Oh dear, that's
oh dear.
Got me. Yeah.
Yes, that's all. That might be all of us. But if you think about it, governments in the West have record amounts of debt that needs to be paid back. We've got tuition fees have been added on to young people. Their chances of owning a home, which probably most of us took for granted, are diminishing. Even their chances of having a great pension are diminishing. So proponents of Bitcoin would say, actually, and as a point of evidence, they would point out that 90% of Bitcoin are owned by millennials or Gen Z, which means people below 40. 90% of Bitcoin in the world has been bought by people under 40. Why? Because they feel it's that generation that has been let down by our current system of currencies. So that's one argument for Bitcoin. The second argument, which is often given, which I'll summarise, is in developing countries. And in developing countries, there's a couple of things. We all know about migrant workers, don't we? Especially, you know, post Qatar and the World Cup, we heard a lot about migrant workers. And one of the things that migrant workers need to do in developing countries is send money home. Previously, to send money, people in developing countries generally don't have bank accounts, don't have credit cards, don't have, you know, whatever, checkbooks. And Bitcoin has provided a mechanism where all you need is two phones and an internet connection to send money back home. And the alternative in the past was to get on a bus for 2 days and two nights and take cash. And then the last argument for Bitcoin in developing countries is that it can develop, it can benefit developing countries where there's hyperinflation. If you live in a country where inflation is 1,000%, and it is in some countries, cryptocurrencies can actually appear quite stable. And so you find that countries like El Salvador or Venezuela or Central African Republic, they have adopted Bitcoin as legal tender, as a means to try and create wealth, to bypass their dependence on the US dollar. So, you know, just to end that, again, proponents for Bitcoin would say it would always tend to be older people in Western countries who argue against Bitcoin because we're the ones who least benefit.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Yeah, and I can see the force of that. I suppose, on the other hand, you think, okay, so these are the people who are most financially vulnerable, and yet what you're proposing is an income that, you know, a currency that has the possibility of having a catastrophic crash, you know, over the space of minutes and losing, you know, huge amounts of money. So I can see the arguments are finely balanced, aren't they? And I do get the point that particularly I can see in developing countries having this form of currency which isn't tied to any power base in the sense of a Western government or the Chinese Communist Party or whatever it is. You've got a currency here which is completely separate from any political system. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it does tap into this kind of techno-optimism, which we've talked about several times in previous podcasts, that really comes out of the Silicon Valley mindset. You know, you can trace it all the way back to the sort of 60s, kind of hippie culture, and then, you know, the very early days of the internet, the idea of open source software, of information wants to be free, the very idealistic view of the technology is going to solve the world's problems, and the best thing to do is to make it open source and freely available and all the rest. Sadly, you know, what we've seen over the last 40 years is that so much of that idealism in the new tech has got corrupted by capitalism, by, you know, now, or else by a kind of, you know, by totalitarian governments who are using this technology for surveillance. And this perhaps sort of naive optimism that technology is going to be liberating, this kind of digital technologies, has largely dissolved. What do you think about that?
Well, a couple of things. So, you know, the mentality of Silicon Valley, it is a kind of a bubble of its own. It is based on optimism. I remember my CEO in the last company I worked for, which was based in Redwood City, California. You know, his phrase was, "We will fail fast." That basically, we don't worry about failure. We try something, it doesn't work. We try something else, it doesn't work. We try something else. Mm. And that is a culture and a mindset. I mean, Zuckerberg's, what was his he had
move fast and break things.
Yeah, which is you know what, I understand what he means. It wasn't the best way of putting it. So that is a mentality that comes out of Silicon Valley. And I think, to be fair to them, it's led to, you know, to the world's most valuable companies. You know, Apple is valued now at something like $2 trillion, more than most countries. So from a capitalist perspective, something about it is definitely working. Mm. Now, I mean, are you asking me whether it's kind of ethically right or wrong?
No, I think it's just thinking about this this view of the future, you know, this idea of progress.
Okay.
It's a very deep-rooted idea.
Yeah.
And but in some ways, you can see it as a kind of distortion of a Christian understanding
I think
of
that's
the future,
true.
Isn't it?
You know, I think that's true. And I mean, you know, I'm sure you know, we call that technicism, where technology will solve all the world's problems. And indeed, I think it's Google who started a company called Calico Labs 5, 6, 7 years ago. And the mandate of Calico Labs is to, quote unquote, solve the problem of death.
That, that's right.
Yeah, you know, whether that's using AI or whether it's, you know, cryogenic engineering or whatever it is. So yes, it does have an overinflated view of itself, and there is a point at which this contradicts Christian ethos, definitely, I think.
So what about just thinking then about the from a Christian perspective, it's interesting perhaps just to step back a bit and say, how do we, you know, the biblical view, you know, is so much in this pre-industrial, pre-technological, you know, it's thinking of the parable of the talents and the guy digging and burying his talent. And how do we translate this very pre-technological, rural understanding of riches, of wealth, of poverty, you know, into this incredibly sophisticated world of fintech, digital currencies and so on?
That is a hard question, John. I mean, I would let's just think about a couple of the elements of it. So, the Bible doesn't say anything specific about cryptocurrencies. It does have principles for ethical behavior, for good stewardship, for generosity, for not exploiting the vulnerable. And we have to bring all of those into play when we consider investments in this case. So the parable of the talents, you know, and I'm sure people know that, the master of the house goes away and calls in the three servants, and he gives one of them 5 talents or bags of gold, as some translations say, the next one 3 talents, and the last one 1 talent, and comes back sometime later and says, what did you do with your talents? And the guy with 5 says, I made an extra 5. And he says, you know, good and faithful servant. And the guy with 3 says, I made an extra 3. And the master says, good and faithful servant. But the guy with 1 actually went and dug a hole in the ground and put it in a hole in the ground. And he says, basically, I was afraid because you know, I was afraid of you, that you reap where you have not sown and you take what's not yours. He has this distorted view of the master, which is Jesus. And out of fear, he doesn't do anything. And I think the moral of that story is not so much about where you plan your financial investments. You could take it that way. It's more about, you know, it's okay to fail. You know, it's okay to get things wrong. It's not okay to put what we have in a hole in the ground and simply be afraid and not do anything. Now, you know, how does that translate into modern day living? I think we require great wisdom and the Holy Spirit.
I guess the other thing that always jumps out at me when you read the Gospels in particular is Jesus has a lot to say about the dangers of the love of money and you know, the risks of infatuation with the kind of material things of this world. And I have to be honest, when I follow a lot of the kind of conversation in the media around cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, I see increasingly not that many people taking a kind of thoughtful nuance. This is an interesting technological breakthrough, and let's explore if we can build an industry. But there is a lot of kind of giddy, greedy excitement about, great, if you buy a 0.1 of a Bitcoin now and you keep holding and holding and holding, next year you could drive a Ferrari because you'll be a millionaire.
Yeah.
Is there a way, do you think, that we could get into this sector without getting sucked into that kind of avaricious mindset, which is clearly kind of antithetical to the way of Christ?
Yeah, so no, you're absolutely right. And so we, you know, Jesus speaks of the parable of the rich fool who simply wants to build bigger and bigger barns to store all his wealth. And I think James specifically calls out, avoid get rich quick schemes. And potentially lots of technological areas including crypto, do have the aura of a get-rich-quick scheme. And that will always attract a certain mindset, a certain type of greed, a certain type of fear of missing out, or FOMO. And yet, Jesus also tells us to be as shrewd as snakes and innocent as doves, use our gains to help others. So how do you mix all that up together? And is there a way to be involved in this without being sucked into the greed, I guess, is what you're asking. And again, I don't have an easy answer except to say, I'm very neutral on Bitcoin personally. I'm very interested in it. I still haven't invested in Bitcoin. I have the means to invest. I have an account, but I've never actually done anything with it. I'm interested as a technologist. I think we have to. Anybody, looking at anything like this has to take the view that whatever your view on Bitcoin is, it is very high risk. And you could lose a lot of money as well as make some money. Is that wise? Somebody said to me, if I've got money that I don't need, why wouldn't I invest in Bitcoin? But my reply was, well, if you've got money that you don't need, why don't you give it away? Because as Christians, aren't we called to do that?
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? Because I think there is a pushback in the secular world against this sort of greed is good. And I think we're probably going to try and do a podcast in the future about this interesting movement called efficient or effective altruism, whereby it encourages people to accumulate wealth not for its own good, but so that they can invest in worthwhile projects and be altruistic. So I think there is something in the human heart which does want to be generous, which does want to be good to others, and I think it is a wonderful principle, isn't it, that the more we give, the more generous we are. We serve a generous God, and the more we live out like Him, and we're generous with what God has given us, the more blessings we receive. Not necessarily financial blessings, but other blessings. It is genuinely better to give than to receive.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think to your point, that altruism is increasingly seen as a way of living, as a way we should aspire to, whatever our faith. We have the well-publicized, Gates Foundation and Warren Buffett, and I think even Zuckerberg, who've all either actually given or have committed to give the vast amount, the vast majority of their wealth to charities, and arguably, the Gates Foundation have done an awful lot in tackling malaria in developing countries. So that is a good thing, and I think we should take heart in that whether you're a Christian or not. It's increasingly seen as, we have a responsibility that's wider than just me and my family. Or as Tim said, getting the Ferrari.
But what I find really fascinating about this in particular is that the world of effective altruism has collided with the world of cryptocurrency. And so we mentioned in last week's episode about the exchange FTX, which kind of imploded spectacularly late last year, and the founder and of that, Sam Bankman-Fried, who's now under arrest and indictment for fraud, he was one of the biggest boosters and investors in the effective altruism world, including funding lots of projects here in the UK, actually, because there's a big kind of center of effective altruism at the University of Oxford. And it kind of, effective altruism started out as a really well-intentioned, humble approach to say, how do we get the most bang for our buck? If I'm giving £1 to this charity versus £1 to that charity, which is going to save the more lives? But what is fascinating is that as it got kind of bigger and entangled with that kind of techno-optimist Silicon Valley world, they started to be to drift, as far as I understand from my reading, towards an idea of the most ethical thing you can do is to get as rich as possible as quickly as possible, because then you have more money to give away. Yeah. And so actually it becomes ethical to pursue extreme wealth, whether that's through, you know, cryptocurrency or you know, getting involved in other kind of traditional financial industries where you can make a lot of money in a very short space of time. And it just seems fascinating to me how even that really good desire to be altruistic and to be effective in altruism has got gradually and imperceptibly corrupted and perverted and twisted by that equal kind of common human predilection, which is our sinful greed.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, the case that you cite, the guy Sam Bankman-Fried, Bankman being an ironic name, really, because he's not a banking man, you know, they're now up for fraud, you know, against fraud for fraud charges and misappropriation of billions of dollars. And it can never be right to pursue wealth at all costs and then say, well, I was going to give some of it away. It does bring up another point as well, though, which is the lack of regulation in the whole crypto area. And that is another conversation that regulation in tech, and you probably know, I'm sure you'll know that the European Union has been chasing Google and Facebook for years and saying, we're going to regulate you, we're going to regulate you if you don't sort your own house out. And similarly, you know, regulation in the world of crypto, would that help? Some regulation would help, because certainly we don't want the likes of the Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX happening every year. Some regulation would help, but you have to be careful with regulation. First of all, for two reasons, one of which is obvious, and the second reason I don't think is obvious. But there's two reasons that regulation in the tech industry can be a bad thing. The first one is that basically it slows everybody down. You know, it never seems to end, and increasingly bureaucracy does weigh companies down, does reduce profitability, does hold back on innovation. The second reason, though, that regulation in this area of crypto or any area of tech can prove to be counterproductive is that if you think about it, the companies, the big crypto exchanges and the big tech companies, Google, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, they have more lawyers than you can shake a stick at. They have more lawyers just in those group of companies than probably the FTSE 100 companies put together. So if you create regulation, what you actually do is you create a world where the huge companies, the Googles and the Apples and the Facebooks and the big crypto exchanges, well, they're okay, because they can throw more lawyers at it than the EU can. And what you've actually done is you've made it really hard for the entrepreneur, the two guys working in a garage. You've raised the bar of entry so high now that they can't innovate. They effectively cannot innovate because they cannot cope with the regulation. So it's not true that regulation always helps and solves of these sorts of problems.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? The law of unintended consequences, I think, operates so often, doesn't it? And it seems to me almost inevitable that some kind of regulation which is designed to do A turns out actually almost having completely the opposite effect because of unintended consequences. I suppose, again, just thinking through biblical principles, it does seem to me, certainly in the Old Testament, and to some extent in the New as well, that the protection of what in Israeli society were the widows, the orphans and the aliens, you know, the people who were most vulnerable, the people who were at the bottom of the heap, the ones who always lost out because they had no power, they had nobody on their side. It seems to me, I've heard it said by a theologian, that, you know, in Old Testament thinking, the primary purpose of an economy is not wealth generation, it is the protection of widows, orphans and aliens. So now that may be an overstatement, but I do think it's a really important sort of counterbalance, isn't it, to a kind of capitalism that sees economic growth and wealth creation as being the essentials of what financial services and financial activity is all about. What do you make of that?
I think I agree. I think it can become very uncomfortable as well. for all of us. I remember once having to write an essay at Theological College on the question, is the Bible biased towards the poor, actually biased towards the poor? And in doing that, I remember, you know, you come across some theologies. So, for example, there's a theology called liberation theology, which comes from South America, from the streets and the slums of South America. And in that theology, when Jesus criticizes the rich or says it's, you know, it's impossible for a rich man to go through the eye of a needle, or when the Old Testament criticizes the rich, we in the West, we tend to think, oh, that's people richer than us. That's Bill Gates, right? That's Zuckerberg. But actually, they think it's us. They think it's us in the West, because we have got rich as a nation and as individuals by exploiting often their countries. And then when there's this, the last being first, that's them. And the first being last, that's us. And that kind of, we don't often hear that taught in churches. We might end up being somehow last. And yet that is a legitimate way of reading scripture.
And this ties into your point you made earlier about the kind of the, one of the critical arguments people make in favor of cryptocurrencies is that it is a vital kind of tool of financial emancipation for people in kind of low resource countries that are unbanked, you know, excluded from the traditional financial sector. It's a nuanced, contested argument, but I can certainly see the power of an argument which says, wouldn't it be wonderful if there was a kind of universal, free at the point of use currency by which we could all convert, send money, receive money, invest, grow, lend, and it's a genuinely universal thing that could serve to break down barriers. You know, in the same way, you know, you see in the Old Testament, they command the kind of the wealthy landowners don't glean to the edge of your fields, but baked into the system is provision for the widow who can go behind the workers, as we see in the Book of Ruth famously, and pick up, you know, free, effectively a kind of proto version of a kind of welfare state almost. And I can see the argument is quite compelling that kind of traditional finance has over many generations has excluded developing nations and poorer people. And I guess the question is can Bitcoin and the like kind of generally provide a sustainable, meaningful alternative, or will people end up getting kind of sucked into scams and Ponzi schemes, or kind of deluded by the kind of get rich variety of the culture?
And actually, you know, and you mentioned Ponzi schemes a couple of times, that just to be clear, there are many cryptocurrencies out there. We've only talked about Bitcoin, really. Some of them almost certainly are scams. You know, there are certainly hundreds of different cryptocurrencies. Some of them definitely are Ponzi schemes. I don't think Bitcoin is. It has a network. It has the mass of people behind it. It's crashed, but it's still going. And there are financial institutions investing in staff, clever young people to do this. So, but you know, I think your point is fair. Actually, that you know, throughout Scripture, that is a mandate. And I like your analogy to gleaning on the edge of the field, that as we should all take that as a principle, that it also gave Ruth in that case a respectable forms of employment, didn't it? And again, that Bitcoin proponents would say that this is a form of generating employment in countries and to people who otherwise couldn't do that.
So I think sort of drawing the threads together, I think it's been a really interesting conversation, because I think this is the kind of conversation we need to have, don't we, amongst ourselves. And so far, there seems to have been a real dearth of serious, informed Christian engagement with this new fintech area. And I mean, it's a fairly crass and obvious thing to say, but I mean, it is so clear, isn't it, that what we need are Christian believers who are experts in this fintech area and who are going to go in it to be salt and light for Christ, and to use their entrepreneurial and tech skills in order to try and create a system which does protect vulnerable people, which does allow the powerless
to have access to funds and which protects them from abuse. I think there's a long way to go, but at least we're starting to recognise the direction we need to go in.
Yeah, and you know, whether cryptocurrencies, to what extent they will empower people in developing countries and people, younger people who have been left out of Western economies, or to what extent they will tempt us into greed and get rich quick schemes, that definitely remains to be seen.
And it is interesting, again, it reminds me of another spiritual principle, one of the mysterious parables that I think one of the most mysterious and profound of Jesus' parables is the parable of the wheat and the weeds, that the wheat and the weeds are growing together, almost indistinguishable, the good and the evil. And it mysteriously, it seems to be that it's God's plan for this age, that the wheat and the weeds should grow together, intertwined. It's only at the end of the age that there will be a clear separation. This was good, this was evil. This was wheat, this was weeds. But for now, in this age, the wheat and the weeds are growing together, intertwined. And I think we can see that in this kind of area, can't we? That there is clearly some real wheat here. There is potential good, but at the same time, there is definite weeds and risks and things that are going horribly wrong.
I think there's a lot of good could come out of this area, a huge amount of good come out of this area, and at the same time, it's definitely a pit for people to fall into, in terms of get rich quick schemes. I think in terms of wheat and weeds, I take that comparison, and even push it one stage further, that it's because of the inevitable hype that we have in the tech industry. Things are overhyped, and you may have seen the hype curve that's been used in the past, that new technologies are overhyped, and then the hype reaches a point and it falls off the edge of that point into what's called a trough of disillusionment, which may be where we are now with cryptocurrencies. But out of that arises something more realistic. So almost, you know, it's not just wheat and weeds, it's weeds that look like great wheat. I mean, that's the point, isn't it? We often, discernment, we can't, it looks great, it all looks great.
We can't tell the difference.
And discernment, I think, is the critical word there, Chris, because that seems to be how actually we end a lot of these podcasts, when we're considering kind of breakthroughs in technology, whether that's, you know, around AI and chatbot software, or whether it's about kind of interesting new things with kind of fertility treatments and healthcare. It's not as simple as, this is great, Christians, jump on board, or this is horrible and sinful, run away. It's of, this is complex, this is changing, and what the kind of Christian response is to ask the question, how do I grow in wisdom so that I can discern what is wheat, what is weeds, what is profitable, what is not, what is wise, what is foolish? And that's a kind of probably a lifelong kind of journey we're also kind of called to go on as believers, is growing in wisdom, not just dividing up everything new into that's good, bad, a pile, and that's a bad pile, but actually wisdom to know how to kind of live in the messy grey as our world kind of accelerates away with this technological revolution we're all living through.
Yeah, and in terms of wisdom and learning from the past, I think one lesson it's always worth reminding ourselves of when it comes to technology is that with all new technologies that succeed, they are always overhyped. We always overestimate their impact in the short term and inevitably underestimate their impact in the long term. So think about a smartphone or something, because that was the industry I worked in, and you know, in the 1990s it was a phone. You know, you use it to speak. You now use it to run your life. So again, that I'm sure that will be the case with this technology. It will be overhyped in the short term, and we'll overstate its benefits, or any other technology, AI, you know. But in the longer term, these have the potential to profoundly change the way we view our world and the way our world works. And as Christians, you know, we need that wisdom, and also the wisdom we've talked about in the last 20 minutes of the biblical wisdom of how do we use this for good.
Yeah, Well, that seems like a brilliant place to draw this series of episodes to a close. Thanks again, Chris, for kind of going on this journey with us, sharing your insight and your knowledge. It's been brilliant to have you helping us kind of pick our way through the weeds and think a bit more deeply about this. And thanks, everyone, for listening. As always, there's plenty more resources on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. You can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we'll be back next week, next Wednesday, with another episode. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Life can be chaotic. If you're running a retail business, don't let disorganized order fulfillment add to the chaos. Use ShipStation instead. With ShipStation, you never have to worry about shipping and fulfillment again. Whether you're running a business out of your garage or you have multiple warehouses, ShipStation is ideal for every phase of your business's growth. Save time with one login for all your stores and by automating repetitive tasks. Plus, you'll save money with the best shipping rates from global carriers. ShipStation's industry-leading features help you deliver a better customer experience. They'll get accurate and faster shipments, along with automated tracking updates with your branding. And with up to 88% off UPS and USPS rates, and up to 90% off FedEx rates, ShipStation is the fastest and most affordable way to ship. Calm the chaos. Switch to ShipStation today. Start a free trial at ShipStation.com/audio. That's ShipStation.com/audio.